We begin our program tonight with a discussion with Chuck Collins. Chuck Collins is director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good and a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Chuck is the author of several books, including a co-author along with Bill Gates Sr. of the book titled Wealth and Our Commonwealth, and a forthcoming book due to be published this fall titled Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. The publisher is Chelsea Green. Chuck, great to have you back on the program tonight. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And I think before we get going here, I wanted to have you tell us briefly about your work, both at the Institute for Policy Studies, as well as with the group The Patriotic Millionaires.
Sure. Well, I've been working for a couple decades on these issues of growing income and wealth inequality. And at the Institute for Policy Studies, we have a web portal called inequality.org, which is sort of a source for data and commentary and solutions to the inequality issues. And for a couple of years, I helped also organize a network of high, wealthy individuals concerned about these issues of inequality. We had a project called Wealth for the Common Good. And over a year ago, we merged together with an emerging group called the Patriotic Millionaires. We basically joined forces to lift up the voices of business leaders, wealthy individuals who support fair taxes, higher wages, and reducing the influence of money in politics. And we have about 250 Patriotic Millionaires who are willing to kind of get out there and talk about these issues.
Yeah, well, certainly before the end of our discussion tonight, we'll talk a little bit more about the projects that your groups have going on leading up to the election in November. But we've been doing radio interviews for a long time, Chuck, and I can't remember any time in recent U.S. history where the issues of income and wealth inequality have been the focus of a presidential election campaign like they are today in 2016. And I guess thanks in part to the Occupy Wall Street movement, the Bernie Sanders campaign, as well as your very hard work all these years working to bring these issues to the fore. And I guess maybe the main engine of these issues as we're seeing them come into focus this year is the fact that people all across this country know full well from their own personal situation that they're losing ground. And their kids maybe don't have as equal or good a chance as they did as they were coming up in the world. But maybe I could get your perspective here and what we're seeing develop in 2016 that we haven't before when it comes to debating the issues of income and wealth inequality.
Well, I definitely agree, Scott, that there's an awakening, that more and more people are drawing connections between their own economic circumstances and these larger economic trends. I think coming out of the economic meltdown, we sort of started to break the taboos around talking about class and inequality. And I think part of that is that, you know, we have a very high tolerance for inequality in the United States. As long as we feel the system is working, for the rules are fair, and that anybody can work hard and have the opportunity to get ahead. And I think what's happening is more people are realizing that the rules are rigged, and that social mobility is declining, that people are working extremely hard, but they're stuck in first gear, or they're slipping backwards. And I think that's people's real life experience. And then I think, yeah, when you have somebody like Bernie Sanders get up and say, this isn't just your individual problem, this is a societal problem, it's a systemic problem, I think it lifts that issue up. But I even think Donald Trump's campaign is, in a way, speaking to the same problem, which is a growing number of people who feel like they are just slipping backwards, whether it's because of global trade or whatever explanation they have. It's the same symptoms, if you will.
Thanks, Chuck, for that. And I just wanted to, I just came across this report today in Think Progress. According to a new analysis by economist Emmanuel Saez, Americans in the bottom 99% of the country's income distribution saw their take-home pay rise 3.9% in 2015 over 2014's levels, adjusted for inflation, the best increase they've seen in 17 years. But the top 1% of the country far outpaced them. The wealthy's income grew by 7.7% last year, reaching a new high that gives us income inequality that is at the highest level in our entire U.S. history. So we've still got this problem going on despite the recovery from the deep nether regions of the recession in 2008 forward.
Yeah, I think we have to say there's something in the wiring, if you will. There's something in the way the rules are designed where asset owners at the top of the economy are seeing their prospects and situations rapidly improve, and wage earners are just not getting ahead. It's good news that there's a little bit of an uptick, but we're talking about almost a 40-year trend now where real wages have pretty much stayed flat for at least 80% of the population. And so I think we're living in a time of extreme inequality, and as you say, it may be we're now passing the levels of inequality that existed a century ago when we used to talk about it as the Gilded Age.
Now, when we talk about the erosion of the middle class, given your knowledge of some of the economic statistics out there, how much of a loss are we seeing in the middle class in the United States, which, of course, used to pride itself on having the largest middle class in the entire world?
You know, if you look at, you think about what does it mean to be middle class, it's the ability to save money, to purchase a home, to stop working before you die, to actually retire, to maybe take a paid vacation, leave something for your children. If you look at all those indicators, we're heading in the wrong direction. Our home ownership rate is going down, and it has been for almost 10 years. Slowly, the percentage of people who own their own home is going down. Savings is going down. The number of households that have retirement funds are going down. So it really is, we have become two very different nations. I mean, we're fragmented in different ways, but there's one group that's sort of propelling like a rocket forward and kind of lives in its own bubble of affluence, and it sort of feels like things are okay. And there's this growing number of people who are very stressed out, and in some ways that they're masking that by borrowing money, or multiple earners, income earners in a household sort of mask some of those trends. But it's a fundamental way we're pulling apart.
Without getting into too many the weeds of policy, but just generally speaking, when you look at the political platform of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, what do you see in terms of ways these candidates and the Democratic and Republican parties are what are they doing to address income inequality, if anything?
Even the Republican candidate Donald Trump now supports raising the minimum wage to $10, and
that's a reversal for him, because he once said the minimum wage was too high just a couple of
that's
months
right.
back.
That's right. So I think the U.S. public overwhelmingly supports raising the minimum wage. So to the extent he's paying attention to public opinion, that's a prudent position. So both parties advocate raising the minimum wage by different amounts. Both parties, interestingly, support putting a wall between commercial banking and regular banking, the so-called Glass-Steagall provisions. Interesting to see that in both party platforms. The tax policies is where you see things sort of pull apart. The Democratic Party talking about a Wall Street financial tax on financial transactions, a higher income tax on the 1% of income earners, and Donald Trump's tax plan, which is always a work in progress, still gives huge tax breaks to the top 1%. I mean, we're talking $7 to $10 trillion in tax breaks over a decade, mostly going to the very wealthy. So taxes where you see the traditional rift between the parties. Interesting on trade, you know, so you have a Republican candidate who is, you know, kind of anti-free trade, and candidate Clinton saying she's opposed to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. That's a huge shift, where the elites of both parties have traditionally supported free trade. But those are some of the policies that I think we can begin to see would shift the inequality dynamics.
We're speaking with Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good, and a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, and part of the group Patriotic Millionaires. Chuck, I wanted to ask you about the vehicles for change in terms of reversing inequality. Tax policy is huge. If you had the ear of a president or powerful politicians in Congress and could recommend changes to our tax code or tax policy overall, what would be the most important things that you would recommend?
I guess I would reverse some of the tax cuts for the wealthy that we've put in place over the last couple decades. So I would raise the top income tax rates on, you know, incomes over $1 million up. I would make the inheritance tax, or what we call the estate tax, more progressive, meaning estates over $1 billion, I would have to pay at a much higher rate than estates over $10 million, which is where it starts. I would put in place a financial transaction tax, which it slows some of the speculative activity on Wall Street, but it also raises substantial money. And I would, if I could, link some of those revenue raisers to things that actually would make a huge difference in people's lives. So I think a debt-free college education fund, certainly at public and state universities, could be easily funded by a financial transaction tax or a more robust tax on wealth and inheritances. Those are the kinds of things that we did after World War II. 1947 to 1977, we taxed the wealthy at higher rates, and we invested in things that helped broaden opportunity, home ownership, debt-free education, infrastructure investments that employed people. Those are the kind of things that I think we should do again.
Well, Chuck, what about tax avoidance? We have, hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, going into offshore tax havens from wealthy folks here in the United States and all across the world. But when it comes to the United States, what could be done to prevent all these tax revenues that could support infrastructure and education and these other investment programs? What could be done to stem the flow of dollars outside the U.S. and the tax revenue that goes with it?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things. There's, as you mentioned, Scott, the offshore system that the Panama Papers and others have revealed. And then there's the huge kind of loophole industry, both that individuals and corporations use to reduce their taxes. Those are actually things that can be fixed if there's a political will. There are certain trust mechanisms that are just set up entirely for the purpose of tax dodging, and those could just be ruled illegal. Some of the international stuff would have to be done in concert with other countries. We would need treaties to expand transparency of both corporate tax reporting and individuals' ability to hide their wealth around the world. But the United States has huge power in that equation. The United States took the lead, other countries would certainly follow. So it's really a question of political will. You and I and our listeners just need to say it's not okay that there's this huge sort of shadow tax system that allows global corporations and very wealthy people to sort of opt out of their responsibilities to paying taxes. But it's totally fixable.
Related to that, I'm sure many of our listeners are aware, there's a lot of speculation that Donald Trump is not revealing his taxes as other presidential candidates have over many, many years, because there's the idea that he probably didn't pay much or maybe anything in taxes given the loopholes available to people like him as real estate developers. So I guess we can't know for sure, but he's an example of the problem, I'm sure.
Yeah, I imagine that there are two issues there. One is that he probably aggressively uses depreciation and other tax loopholes to game his taxes down. The other probably concern is that he's not really as rich as he wants us all to believe. He's constantly talking up his own the value of his assets. But I think they just may not be that impressive. And I think that would undermine his boasts about his billionaire status.
Chuck, you recently wrote about Canada and the Nordic countries and the systems they have in place that really tamp down inequality in their nations. I think with Canada in mind, you wrote that Canada has three times the social mobility that the U.S. now has. And tell us a little bit about what we could learn from Canada and the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah, I think, you know, this might be a shock to some of our listeners. You know, we like to think that we're the socially mobile society. It doesn't matter where you're born. As long as you work hard, you can advance up the economic ladder. That is kind of an old story about the United States, unfortunately. And that is in part because as we've become more unequal and stopped investing in things that create opportunity, Canada and the Nordic countries have been investing in early childhood education, early health intervention, early support for people with learning disabilities, debt-free education. They've been making the kinds of investments that good societies make to raise the floor so nobody falls below a certain income and opportunity threshold. And then they've made huge investments so that you don't have to be born wealthy to have a good life. And so they have more social mobility now. People have a greater opportunity to climb the ladder and achieve what we call the American dream. They're better off if you're not born wealthy in the United States and you want to attain the American dream, you're better off living in Canada now.
Well, Chuck, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you this question, and I'll be speaking to a Bernie Sanders supporter later tonight who attended the convention in Philadelphia. But if you were an advisor to some of these very passionate Bernie Sanders supporters who have a mind to continue their political activism in the coming year, hopefully after the election is over in November, what would you have them focus on in terms of economic inequality? What kind of political agitation do you feel would be useful and an efficient use of their time?
Well, I guess my encouragement would be to remember that it's not really about the candidates. It really is about all of us organizing, making our voices heard, maybe even running for office. So I would encourage people to sort of join the Our Revolution network that's forming. Treat it just like it's a presidential campaign, even though it's really building a movement outside the political system. Although I think, you know, we should also be looking at around at each other and saying, who among us is going to run for local city council? Who's going to run for state senator? Who's going to run for state representative? And do what the Tea Party's done very effectively, which is build leaders and build candidates who first and foremost want to talk about these issues of inequality and the climate crisis and the other pressing issues of our time. So I would encourage people not to be discouraged, to understand we put huge pressure on the political system and on the platform and have changed the conversation. And to keep that work going, basically have to keep doing it at all different levels.
And one very hopeful sign that emerged out of the Bernie Sanders campaign among many was the fact that they proved that you can raise enormous amounts of money from small donors all across this country to be, you know, almost in a competitive league with somebody like a Hillary Clinton, a veteran politician, you know, with connections all across this world. It was very impressive and, shows the potential of that kind of grassroots organizing. Chuck.
Yeah, and you can imagine if the Our Revolution movement raised a fifth of that money, you know, it raised $30-40 million and put an organizer on every campus to organize students around tuition-free education and put an organizer in a whole bunch of key congressional districts to help lift up local candidates, that would have a huge impact on the landscape of our political system. So I think we should, the key is to stay engaged, not be discouraged, but stay engaged. Keep the spirit up.
Chuck, lastly, leave our listeners with websites for the groups you work with, IPS, Patriotic Millionaires, and, of course, the online publication inequality.org, which I guess I just gave the URL for that one. But what are the other ones?
I was going to say that's the best one to remember, inequality.org, because you can find the Institute for Policy Studies through that. And you can, but the Patriotic Millionaires is simply patrioticmillionaires.org. And you should check it out. Even if you're not a millionaire, you could become a friend of the Patriotic Millionaires, see what we're doing. And it may be that you are involved locally in an issue, and it would be helpful to have, you know, if you're involved in a campaign for the minimum wage. We have business leaders who are eloquent supporters of why business owners should raise the minimum wage. And we have members who are very eloquent about why we should raise taxes on the wealthy, and are willing to be part of local campaigns and press conferences. So check out both inequality.org and the patrioticmillionaires.org.
Chuck, thank you so much for spending time with us tonight. Great to talk to you again, and you know, great appreciation for all your hard work over these many, many years. That's finally getting some well-deserved traction in the world around us. So thank you so much, Chuck.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Chuck Collins, Director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, a member of the group Patriotic Millionaires.